You are now listening to the next Great Small Business Podcast. Welcome to the SME Stories Podcast, where it is all about small businesses in Canada. And here's your host, Ken Alfred.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having the show. We got a great episode today with TJ Kosin. Now, TJ Kosin is actually a real estate investor. So a little bit about TJ. TJ's been in the market since 2006. He has owned and managed residential real estate from 1 to 112 units, in addition to a residential real estate note portfolio and self-storage facilities. Now, his investment firm, TNT Properties, actually is based in Dallas, right, where they move high volumes of distressed and retail-grade residential properties in the Texas and Florida markets. TNT is a tight-knit DFW-based company that sources direct-to-sellers distressed properties, recapitalizes them, and either holds them in their portfolio or positions them for resale on either the retail, wholesale, or seller finance market. So in addition to that, TJ also has a community and an educational platform. REIF is the actual education platform where they actually teach people the business, showing them how to leverage their time and build their business through optimizing their exit strategies and strengthening their operational and organizational structures. They don't believe in a one-size-fits-all model. They believe that members and students should build the business they want to suit their lifestyles and goals. To that end, they facilitate their success through a robust community whose guiding principle is brutal honesty when it comes to business development. TJ enjoys spending his free time with his two beautiful children, reading with his wife, gardening, trail running, woodworking, golfing, and working out. Oh my. So fun fact, TJ learned to walk when he was 33. So we're actually going to probably dive into that just a little bit because that is a very interesting statement there. So sit back and absorb. All right, guys, we have TJ Kosin. TJ, how you doing?
Hey, Ken, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No, it's actually pretty good now. Like, I think we're recording this in December right now, so it's getting close to that holiday season. And you're in the Texas area, is that correct?
Yeah, we work out of North Dallas, and our company covers pretty much all of North Texas, and we'll occasionally do deals even outside of state, depending on kind of what comes our way.
Nice, and hopefully you guys are getting ready for the holidays and everything. It doesn't snow very much in Texas, I'm assuming.
No, we've been getting like one good snow a year that'll last maybe a couple of days, and that's kind of fun, but it doesn't stay cold, and that's good.
Yeah. Well, here in Canada, unfortunately, it is cold, but there's still no snow yet. I mean, if it was up to me, TJ, I'm just going to say, because I grew up in Canada, so I was like, in a perfect world, there would be like a decent sized snowfall on the December 23rd, and it'll melt by Boxing Day.
That's it. That's fair. Honestly, that's one of the reasons I moved to Dallas almost 10 years ago was I wanted some place with nice weather that was kind of predictable. And everyone thinks that's funny because it gets hot as heck out here. But you know what? It doesn't stay super cold. It doesn't stay super hot for that long. So we like it. We love it out here.
Yeah, but definitely love to go to Texas eventually. So that'll be great. So, all right. So TJ Kosin, what's your story?
Well, we do real estate investing. So we have we're up to 11 people now. That's kind of terrifying, isn't it? In office. And our primary business is direct to seller marketing for distressed residential real estate properties. That's kind of the current picture. So we do a pretty high volume of that. We have anywhere between, I don't know, upper 20s and like upper 30s deals going at a time in some form or another. And like I said, the main thing is the direct to seller marketing and the acquisition side. That's the most critical part of the business. And because if we buy a good deal, then we pretty much have any exit strategy available to us. So that, you know, that changes depending on the market cycle, that changes depending on what we have going on. It changes depending on the deal type itself, obviously, because some deals fit a different exit strategy better than others. But it's also what keeps us really competitive. I would say probably better than a lot of our competition in terms of maybe the one kind of focus shops that are out there.
No, that's pretty cool. And let's backtrack even for a second there. So how did this whole thing get started? So what brought you into real estate in the first place, right? Because I think a lot of people find real estate sexy in a way, you know, whether it's a fix and flipper or the buy and holds, or there's a bunch of other stuff in between. So what drew you to real estate?
The same stuff as everyone, I guess, but I got in right at the wrong time, actually, because if you want to have a long story, I got in 2006. So 2006, the only problem with 2006 was it was right before 2008. No one knew that like at the time. So that was fun, which means, I guess, between then and now, however long that is, there's been a lot of kind of ups and downs and sideways and distractions. And that's definitely one thing about business. It's never linear, right? There's always a, hey, let's try this out. Oh, crap, that didn't work. Let's try something else out. Oh, great. That works great. Let's do that. Oh no, the market's changing. Let's adjust and tweak. So I actually started in apartments in 2006. My first deal was 112 units, highly distressed, that we did a big, massive capitalization project to. My second deal was a little bit smaller. That was only 98 units. So I was really conservative on that one. And then it wasn't until my third deal I did my first house. So that was weird. But it was, like I said, very, very different market, a lot of ups and downs between then and now. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, for most investors that maybe there are people that are thinking about investing in real estate, they're really starting what you're kind of focused on now, which is, you know, residential real estate, probably in like, you know, a single family home or maybe even a, you know, semi-attached. Or you went straight to like over 100 plus unit apartment. So like, so where did you get any kind of training for this kind of things? Is it just something that, okay, I want to invest in real estate. Should I read a book? Is there someone I know that kind of does it already? Or how did you, what was the learning curve for you?
Well, it was pretty steep once we bought. I never said I was the smartest guy out there. Just got in the big deal. No, did a lot of reading, I guess. I was in, I was a loan officer in end of 2005, beginning of 2006. So I saw a bunch, and in California. So I saw a bunch of the subprime kind of loans that were in the marketplace. We didn't really do a lot of the like ninja crazy loans, but we saw those available. And being from the West Coast, I think I was more conscious of like big market fluctuations because we're accustomed to crashes. Like we had a big crash in the 80s about the time I was born when interest rates were like twice what they are now. We had a small crash during the tech thing. And so we're just kind of more accustomed to like big fluctuations. So I didn't want to get into investing in California in 2008 or 2006. That was probably a good choice. So I thought, well, let's look at other stuff out there. My parents had some rental properties, but nothing special. And let's look at other stuff out there. So analyzed a whole bunch of deals, did a bunch of due diligence, looked at a bunch of different submarkets, and ended up actually closing on one that I found off of Craigslist of all places. Because it looked, you know,
really?
Numbers looked promising. Yeah, well, you used to be able to find cool stuff on Craigslist, I guess. Anyway, numbers looked great. And it was, what would I say? I like to say the rehab and the lease up was fantastic until the market just kind of, and then it was a little bit more of a CYA kind of period.
Oh, yeah. Well, here, back up a little bit too. For some of my listeners who, you know, they never invested in real estate and they hear the words rehab and re-up and lease up, can you just break down what those
terms are? Oh, for sure. So the first property, rehab is basically buying something that's distressed in a not fixed up, not retail ready, not necessarily, it can be livable, but maybe not, you know, as economically viable as it should be. And then you go in there, you capitalize it, which is the fancy term in real estate for just saying throw a bunch of money at it and hope it sticks, where you're buying new stuff and making it, you know, nice and livable again. So that's, and again, that's a big part of our current business in the residential side too. Lease up was we bought the place. That's just sticking people in there. So we bought the place. That one was 10% occupied when we bought it. And then it was 94% economically occupied by the time we were done. Which basically means out of available units. So if you're leasing up, if you're rehabbing 100 units, you're doing like maybe 8 units, you know, at a time. And then you're going to lease up those 8 units as you're working on the next 8 units. And we got the rehab done. So I think right at the top, we were probably about the time the market started shifting down. So we probably at our peak were maybe 90-ish% occupied. And it was, like I say, the rehab was very successful. The lease up was very successful. And the economy decided that it wanted to do what it wanted to do. And everyone was in a similar boat, I guess, at the time.
Nice. Wow. That's really interesting there. So that's pretty cool. So back to your business then. So you say about 11 mm-hmm. people right now, and they're all in office. Or are they anything overseas or remote or anything like that?
Yeah, we've played with VAs on and off. Right now we're on an off period, so we don't have any VAs. But no, we have a full team. We're focusing exclusively on residential distressed properties right now. And we like it for a lot of reasons. One, we're really good at it. It was a second big learning curve going from commercial into residential at the time. And I kind of took the same mindset, the volume-based mindset with commercial, with, apartments, and applied it now to residential. Because if you're doing one, it's really tough because one can take your entire quarter down. If you're doing maybe 3 or 4 deals a year, you mess up one deal. Next thing you know, I would say probably actually more like 6 months is completely trashed because now you're trying to recover. So if you're doing, you know, 20 or 30 deals at a time, well, it smooths out the curve a lot. So you can have a deal that loses 20K, but you had, you know, 5 more deals that month that made 20K. You don't feel it quite so bad. So for us, it was a choice as more is better as long as the business model itself is sound. And it's fun. It's a different level of stress, I guess, dealing with a lot of people in office and being responsible for them than it is, you know, doing ones and twos, dropping off paint and negotiating everything by yourself. But we enjoy it for a lot of different reasons.
So of the 11 here, so is some of the mixture of like, you know, admin or salespeople, is there one that does like, or one's the GC, or did you outsource the general contracting piece that does the rehabs?
Oh, no, that's a good point. If you count contractors, we probably have, let me think right now, we have four crews running right now. Each of them have between four and six people, I guess. So that's all outsourced. We subcontract all of our work out on the construction side. And we have crews that we've used for years that we really like. So it's definitely a case of, you know, treat them well and they stick around. That's a huge thing. We pay fair. We don't overpay, but we don't try to underpay unless we really have to. And if we really have to, you know, we explain it to them like, hey, there's a reason this property is a turd. We screwed up. Now we both got to give a little bit here. But on the office side, yeah, we're heavy on the acquisition with negotiations is our biggest kind of core competency. And then we have three people on acquisitions. We have three people on dispositions and sales. We have probably more managers than we need. And an admin. And then my wife does a lot of the like dispo, the sales side. She does all the stuff that's on market. She's a broker. So that's kind of cool. My job is to keep everyone playing in the sandbox, like playing nice with each other in the sandbox. So day to day, I don't really know what I do, but if I'm not here, it doesn't get done. So I guess that's good.
Interesting. I love that. So what are you expecting for, I guess, well, this year's almost done. So for next year, in terms of like growth and profit, what are you thinking of next year? Like what are your plans for next year?
Yeah, we've tried a bunch of different marketing things. I think there's probably three ways to look at it. There's a national market with what the real estate like overall market is likely to do. And I think that's actually relatively easy to make a good determination of over the next 12 months. And not to pat ourselves on the back, but we're generally pretty good at that. We like to say, I don't need to know what's going to happen in 2 to 5 years. I need to know what's going to happen with the amount of time frame that I have inventory currently in the pipeline. So I need to look out 6 months out, maybe 12 months out for kind of a bigger picture. And we've been pretty spot on. Like we knew rates were going to start rising and we knew that was going to have a kind of dampening effect on flips and some of the more risky projects. If anything, we thought it was probably going to slow down the market more than it has. So we were prepared for that and that's good. Over the next 12 months, I think we have one more rate rise in the spring. I don't know if I'm right or wrong about that. But I like to say the market hates uncertainty. So last year when the market hadn't seen rates rising since I got into real estate, really in 2006-07, rates were going up. There's an entire generation that had never seen a higher interest rate environment. So that's going to cause uncertainty. That's going to cause a slowdown and a stall in buying, a slowdown and a stall in selling. On the retail side, which means how do we adjust accordingly? It means we flip less properties and we try to employ a different exit strategy because there's going to be a slowdown in the retail side. We saw that coming. We got bit on a couple deals, but nothing crazy. Not nearly as bad as a lot of people that kind of didn't see it. This year's been good. This year's been stable. And what's contributed to that, I think, is that a lot of people are more kind of, like I said, the market hates uncertainty. I think a lot of people are more certain of where the market is, which means we're kind of accustomed to, okay, now we have higher interest rates. Now we have prices. Everyone thought, oh, prices might go down. We're like, eh, probably not because of a low inventory situation. We're likely to maintain low inventory, which is going to be supportive of prices. And, you know, in the past 2 months, rates on the retail side, conventional, have gone down. If they stabilize lower or continue to go down, that's definitely good for our industry on the retail side. So I think that's probably what's likely to happen. Now, there's always black swan events. There's, you know, Joe Biden getting reelected or not reelected. Who knows? There's the Fed going crazy with lowering rates to try to get him reelected. There's World War III in Ukraine. So black swan events or whatever, you can never predict exactly. But assuming nothing weird comes at us, I think we're likely to see a relatively stable year next year.
That's good. I mean, yeah, like the world is like I always tell people, if you really want to be depressed, watch the news, right? If you really want to. So that's why I try to watch it. Yeah, I try not to watch too much of it. Like I'll try obviously I listen to the news, but more like traffic, right? Just weather and traffic. That's what I'll look at and stuff. I don't know. That's a different type of anger that I'll get, because especially if the weatherman is wrong, right? But aside from that, then, so are you looking to expand your actual office now? You have like 11 in-house in an office right now. Are you thinking about, you know, getting like a bigger office, maybe doubling your staff, or what are you looking at for the next maybe 5 years?
We're at a nice size right now. We started off the year with like 4 less people, I think. So we've expanded quite a bit this year. For the next 12 months, we're looking at increasing our marketing kind of scope. We've tried a bunch of things this year that didn't work. We've tried a bunch of things that did work. So we're going to try to double down on the things that did work very well. We've always been pretty good at the marketing, but as you increase, our industry is the sales guys don't generate revenue. So if you're in like a construction industry or even a car industry, something like that, the sales guys are the revenue generators. In our industry, the way we do it, the leads generate the revenue and the sales guys capture the revenue. So where a lot of people get into trouble is they'll overhire for acquisitions for, you know, buyers for distressed property without having enough leads to feed the team. And now you're going to have attrition. You're going to have people fall out and all that good stuff. So for us, it's always been leads first and then sales guys second in terms of expansion. Right now, we're definitely at a nice capacity with our sales team. They're at a nice training level that we like them at. And we have room for probably one more on each side, more or less. But our next focus for the next 6 months is definitely like streamline some of the lead flow, increase it some, see if we can increase revenue. Maybe, I don't know, maybe 30%. We're not trying to double or go crazy because we don't really want to work that hard, to be honest with you.
Yes. I mean, you want to have enough. You don't want to have too much, not too little, but just enough, right? That's interesting.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So a little bit back when you started this thing, so your current operations right now, what have you found have been like the biggest, you know, expenses that you're kind of seeing right now, right? So you just said before we started the podcast, you're $700 less because you had to approve a Home Depot order, right? So what do you find as the biggest cash outflows you're finding running your business?
That's a good question. I mean, from a strictly capital intensive standpoint, probably obviously the renovation costs are the biggest cash outflow, because we're renovating a bunch of houses a year. So it will be a couple million bucks in renovation cost, which most people, you know, if you're in a construction company, that's probably pretty good. For us, it's obviously a headache and we'd rather renovate less because renovations have the longest turnover time, the longest like time to get your money back out again. So that's our biggest strictly expense, but it's also relatively trackable. As long as we're doing our homework with what the property's worth once we have it recapitalized. That's definitely the biggest expense, but it's also the least kind of, honestly, it's least important in terms of growth. The most important expense in terms of growth is the marketing expense. So we really, we track, lead cost is probably our most important KPI, more important really than contract cost. And maybe the both of them are pretty similar. So we're putting out, you know, how much money does it take to get a contract in? What's our likelihood, you know, close rate on the contract? And then that makes it more more predictable. One thing that's not very predictable is average profitability, because we'll have a deal, you know, we'll have a deal that makes $5,000. And then we'll have a deal that makes $100,000. And so what's the average? Well, the average is like 52 and a half or something, right? That doesn't mean anything. So the average deal profit doesn't really matter. What matters is the repeatability of the deal flow and the repeatability of the acquisition process to make sure that we can get good deals. And then if we can repeat that, then we kind of got to take whatever comes your way to a certain extent. Obviously, don't take stuff because you think you have to do a deal, but make sure you're doing good deals. But you cast a bigger net, you're going to get some of the small and some of the big.
No, absolutely. Is there anything else that you kind of spend your money on that most people probably don't know if they find out that you're a real estate investor, right? So what else do you see? What else do you spend that people don't realize?
Well, this office is expensive. All these guys that are working here, man, they're expensive. Payroll adds up. We pay quick. So we like paying quick. People get paid a pretty healthy commission rate on on the deals that close. And I mean, it sounds kind of weird from a company owner perspective, but we like paying pretty much when the deal closes because we are so rehab heavy on that side. That takes up so much cash that we're always juggling draws between lenders. Stuff is selling, stuff is, you know, in the pipeline to get purchased. So we're always kind of, I think every real estate investor, a little cash poor, which means that sales guys close something, man, you're probably getting paid in 2 or 3 days as soon as the wire hits us because we want to make sure the money's there for you.
Yeah, you're taking some of the money coming in. There you go. There's your reward for finding us that deal and stuff. So you mentioned you have like 20 to 30 deals going on at once. And so how quickly do you close them? Right. So what, I mean, I know you said it's hard to average your profit, but also how like what's the average you know, time you take it over to the time you, whether you sell it or rehab it, whatever, what's that usual timeline?
Yeah, so it's a pretty diverse company. There's a lot of real estate companies that just do like just wholesaling. And wholesaling is effectively, depending on your audience, it's buying a contract at a certain price and then assigning or marking up the contract, you know, a reasonable amount, whatever it is, and then selling the contract at the same time, and you get paid out at the end buyer's closing. So you never actually take title to the property itself, which has a lot of advantages. One of the biggest advantages is your cash conversion cycle is relatively quick. So depending on when the lead came in, we can have a lead that comes in on a Tuesday, if it's a good quality lead, and we can close it. I don't know. I think our record is actually 24 hours, but I mean, realistically, we can close a good quality lead that's ready to go within a week. And if we're wholesaling it, we can get paid then, you know, in a week and several days. So those are, there's a good advantage to that, obviously, for cash flow and cash retention. The disadvantage is it's not always the most optimal exit strategy for the property. So we do that. We do that strategy probably 30 to 40% of the time. As we grow the company, we probably try to favor it a little bit more. Because again, I mentioned our main core like strength is on the buy, on the negotiation, on the purchase side. We're generally very often not the highest bidder on a property or the highest like offer on a property, but we're able to provide value for the sellers in a different way. So we're able to then buy the property at a deeper discount, which is good for us. And then on the other end of the spectrum is a renovation. So a renovation can take anywhere from 3 to 12 months, depending on the scope of it. A 12-month one that we just finished was we bought I forget how big it was. I think 4,500 square foot house that had been the top story had been burned out. About $1 million after repaired value. We bought it for $380, but we put $400,000 into it over a 9-month period or 10-month period, and then sold it. But we knew that going in, and that's on the extreme. But our average flip historically in the past couple of years, I'd love to say it was like super fast, but it's realistically about 6 months entry to exit. So those are the kind of two extremes. And then we'll do, you know, a mix of other types of deals kind of in the middle of there.
Interesting. So, yeah, so you get your wholesaling piece, you have your fix and flip piece. Do you do any buy and holds or anything like that as well? Or
yeah, we have rentals. We're not in love with rentals, to be honest with you, coming from a rental apartment background. Tenants are a pain in the butt. Our main business is generating business revenue, so income from doing the business. And a lot of people think, well, that's not generating generational wealth and all that good stuff. That's not really the objective. The objective is to generate a lot of income that we can continue to grow the business. The business is, in a certain respect, the asset. Obviously, a real estate business like this doesn't really sell. It's not really a sellable asset. But that's what we're trying to generate. But then at the same time, we pick up rentals here and there. So I think we have about 20 right now, but I'm not sure exactly. In the past 12 months, they've been kind of a pain in the butt with... I don't know, everything getting pinched, the economy slowing down a little bit, as long as you're not looking at the stock market, but inflation being higher. The tenants we've had more evictions this year than we have in quite a few years in the past. So you gotta ride the good with the bad. But they're definitely good.
Overall. Yeah, exactly. I mean, when we wanted to get into investment real estate in the past, this is like maybe over 15 plus years ago. You know, my wife, Mrs. K, we were just, you know, we were living in a condo. We were just thinking, oh man, we should, you know, we bought our townhouse. We're like, man, we should really get into real estate or whatever. Right. So she's like, but the only experience she knew of was her aunt, trying to rent out a condo where for some reason, my uncle-in-law would always have to keep going in there because the tenant was always complaining about something. Yeah. Right. So unfortunately, that's all she knew. So when I was thinking, you know, because at the time we were like, well, fix and flipping, that looks more fun to me because I love watching those home renovation shows, even though I know for rehab, you don't want to go do it like it's your own house per se, like, well, you know, golden faucets and all that sort of stuff. Right. But you wanted to make sure like that looked fun because, you know, you can take like that ugly duckling and turn it into a swan or whatever. So I thought, okay, maybe a rental would be good, but that's all she knew. So she was freaked out. We couldn't do it. So I said, okay, fine. So what we ended up doing was just investing in REITs at that time, just because, okay, we got something, we're in the market, you know, and a little bit of that, but we'll touch on that another time. But that is interesting because it is that fine balance, right? Because you can either do the fix and flip where you can make pretty good money, like, you know, really, like you said, like in some cases you're making a lot of money versus, you know, the quote unquote cash flow of the rentals where, you know, for just let's say you're just renting out one unit, let's say you buy a single family home and rent it out, you might make 100, 200 bucks a month, you know, but expand that out, right? So it's that pro and con kind of thing. It's just finding that balance of what your risk tolerance is for that. So back to your business there, you said you focus a lot on finding the leads and a lot of the marketing. So how much of that is like traditional marketing, or how much of it is more social media, word of mouth? How do you do your marketing?
Yeah, there's a good mix. In our industry, we're deep, and we have been deep into online Google PPC. So online marketing through Google. We weren't like the first ones to do it in real estate, but we've been doing it about 5 years. It's getting a lot more popular now. So a lot of more people are doing it, which drives up our lead cost, which then means we just need to be better than them in some other aspect of the business, which is generally providing value to the seller by contacting the lead first or buying better. So we're good at that. We've done cold calling in the past. We're not in love with it because it's a lot longer lead, like just turnover cycle, and we don't enjoy it as much. We do direct mail. So that's mailing out basically postcards or letters or whatever to some kind of list or another. And that can be good because it's still we like focusing on inbound leads. So that's get an inbound lead source. When they get a letter, you know, they call, they tell you to go screw yourself, or they tell you, yeah, I definitely want to sell. So it's pretty easy to qualify whether or not the lead is interested or not. And then it's just obviously like a follow-up sequence. The follow-up sequence is I would say very important, and it's definitely very lead specific. So it's tough to have an automated system if you have an office people that are like tracking, okay, what's the requirements of this lead? And those are the two big ones that we're heavy in right now is PPC and mail. We have a pretty good presence online in the North Texas area. So we get maybe 20% of our business is referral based. We'll help other people sell their deals. We'll buy deals from other people depending on, you know, what they are. And that's kind of, you know, that's a great lead cost because you're not paying for the lead. That's awesome. But then you're solving other problems for the other guy that you're JVing with basically.
Well, yeah, that's interesting that you're talking about. So sometimes you'll have like investors that, you know, either they don't have the capital to do it, or they don't know what to do with this deal that they actually have, and you help them out in some way, shape, or form, whether you said joint venturing with them or just literally buying it off of them, and you just take it because you've been doing this since like 06, right? So yeah. It's, you know, you're not a rookie when it comes. Because I think for a lot of people who want to get involved in real estate, I think a lot of them is that fear, right? Because they don't know what to do, or they're afraid of, you know, especially if they, let's say, the least costly option or something, they're like, oh, what's the cheapest one I can start with, right? Mm-hmm. Because the idea of them getting a property and they either stuck with it because they can't sell it or they can't rent it, and they're like, oh my God, what the hell am I going to do here? So you talked about exit strategy. So for the average Joe, they're like, wait a minute, what do you mean exit strategy? Don't you mean like either if I'm stuck in a property that I can't seem to work with, well, doesn't that mean I can just sell it or rent it? Are there's more than those two?
Those are the two big ones. I guess the question is who you're going to sell it to. And that's obviously there's a rent exit strategy. There's I should sit on and wait for it to appreciate exit strategy, I suppose. But who are you going to sell it to? So that's the biggest piece of the exit strategy that we really dial in on. Again, the acquisition and the negotiations is the most important. If we're buying a deal correctly and we're buying it for the right discount in the right neighborhood, and we know the submarket that it's in, so we know the neighborhood and the dynamics of that neighborhood, then it's really hard to screw it up with any exit strategy. So that's the most important part. Is it's not location, 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 like everyone says in my experience, because I can't think of a single piece of privately owned real estate anywhere in the United States that I wouldn't pay a dollar for. So price overcomes location, I would say almost 100% of the time. I'm sure there's some piece of property I don't want somewhere that I don't think about. But so price is always the most important part. And then obviously location is going to dictate what you can do with the property. So what kind of buyer are we going to target? In the wholesale example where we said we're just going to buy, you know, say you buy it 100 and you sell it for 115 or 120 to someone, generally you're attracting a investor buyer profile. So you're effectively attracting our competition. So then you're going to ask, well, why not just do it ourselves? Maybe we don't want to. Maybe we don't like the property because of some reason. Maybe we don't have enough money because we're doing, you know, 10 others right now. We just don't feel like doing this one. But if we're doing a high volume and we're turning over several a week, we just don't have the capacity construction wise to do every single flip that's in our pipeline. So we got to do something else with it, which is fine.
Right.
Again, the construction, like I said, is the biggest cash suck, that we have from the company, from a strictly just like, where's the cash go perspective. It doesn't mean that whoever buys our property is going to have a bad outcome of the property either. Because if you're doing one or two at a time, you're probably better at controlling costs than I am if we're doing, you know, 10 at a time or whatever. So wholesaling is great. That's going to attract an investor profile. Going up from there, we sell a bunch of deals with seller financing. So we become the bank. You ask more about rentals. We keep some for rentals, but we actually like creating a note on property and then becoming the bank when we sell the property. So that generates recurring cash flow. We just actually, last month is a great example. We did two notes on a property. We bought a property for $100,000. We put $50,000 into the renovation, and then we sold it to $250,000 to an end buyer, where we then became the lender for the property. We actually created two notes. We created a first, but I don't remember what the amount was, because it doesn't matter because we don't own that one anymore. We sold that at closing. And then we created a second of $80,000 that's going to pay us 13% over the next 30 years. So of made up money, because again, we bought it at the 150 level. So we recouped all of our money. We made about, I'm not sure, 20, 25, I don't really care, money when we sold it. We collect 10% down, we qualify the borrower, and we basically collect 13% interest on $80,000 for 30 years or until they pay it off early. So basically we made up $80,000 and then we made up 30 years worth of interest payments on that $80,000. That's a great exit strategy. There's a lot of advantages to it. Is the way we create them, they don't very often default. So there's a very low default percentage on those buyers because we qualify them well and because we vet them, which is, you know, that's always important. A lot of people do it with very little, they do it with a used car lot kind of mentality. Little money down, you know, buy here, pay here kind of thing. Yeah, you can do that. But if you're not qualifying the borrowers, you're going to have a way higher default rate. So out of, I think we've done 45 deals this year. Doing that strategy, we've had like one that's having trouble making payments, which is great. And then from there we go up. We'll sell stuff that's lightly fixed up, that's livable, habitable, and we'll sell it below full retail. What does that do? Well, that provides liquidity for the seller who sold it to us because they want to get out of the property in a certain time frame or because of certain parameters. It provides liquidity on the back end where the real estate investor isn't the bad guy messing up the market and just driving up prices, because we're actually selling inventory now maybe $30,000 to $50,000 to $80,000 below full market value that now has needs some capital improvement to be like absolutely perfect, but it's very livable. So now we're providing an opportunity for someone to have some sweat equity, come in and have some equity in the house, do their own thing. It's livable, it's safe. You know, we fix all the stuff that's like really bad. And it's a good way for us to increase our turnover ratio. And it's a good way for an end buyer to still have some opportunities on the property where a retail level buyer can qualify for the property. Because a lot of these houses, a retail buyer can't qualify for. We're not buying nice houses in nice neighborhoods and then making them the best house out there. We're buying turds that are, you know, stacked full of trash, and then we're fixing them. At least on the rehab side. So that brings us to the rehab, and that's the HGTV stuff. That's our least favorite, but it's the most sexy on the YouTube channels because you're going in there with the granite countertops and the new doors and the new drywall and the new roof and the 35.
I forgot the sledgehammer.
Yeah, 35K rehab that turns into 50K because you missed a bunch of stuff. And you're not making as much money as you think because the market stagnated and because you spent too much on your rehab. But that's the easiest one to understand because you're generally targeting a full retail buyer at full retail pricing. So those are the main exit strategies that we employ in the business. That was a long answer. I'm sorry.
That was a long answer. I think that's the record there, TJ. So I'll let you take a sip there. So we'll talk about the industry itself here. So like kind of what is your, I guess, opinion on the current, let's say, the real estate investment space right now, and where do you think it's going?
Well, there's which aspect, I guess. Let's maybe go from the market perspective, because there's always the regulatory side, which is getting tighter on some of the kind of cowboys in the marketplace. There's definitely regulations that are coming down in different states for strictly wholesaling, which, to be honest, is probably good, because a lot of any business you can do ethically and unethically. If you're a realtor, you can be an unethical realtor and a lion, you know, sack. Or you can be an ethical realtor. So the same thing in our investment business. There's plenty of ways to do our business unethically, and there's plenty of ways to do it ethically. So anything where you can make this much margin, you're going to attract a certain percentage of people who, in my opinion, don't operate their business ethically. So there's going to be some of that. The impendingness of that is going to depend, at least in the U.S., like state by state. And as the market slows down, that's when people start to tend to get into trouble. I think a little bit more. If the market's going great, everyone's always happy. But when stuff stagnates, stuff gets a little more hairy, I guess. But as far as the market itself is concerned, we saw a slowdown for sure last fall as interest rates started going up a year ago fall. We saw a bit of a slowdown, more of a seasonal slowdown, September, October this year, but that's a lot more indicative of a kind of standard traditional market that tends to slow down around school time. We're seeing an uptick actually in the end of November through December of showings of all kinds of stuff, partially because our rates have come down now some, and partially just because people are starting to realize, like I said, the market hates uncertainty. There's a lot more certainty in the market than there was a year ago. Going forward, I think we continue to see more of that certainty. I think our Fed has indicated that they're, again, I think they probably have one more rate rise in them, but I think the consensus is that they're probably going to start lowering rates end of Q3, Q4 next year. Now that might stagnate things a little bit. Maybe people wait to buy, but there's always a demographic of people. It also means that people are going to wait to sell, which is going to mean that we're going to continue to have low inventory, which means that people like us that are in the business of turning over inventory are going to be able to kind of maintain. We've used the uncertainty probably to our advantage on the acquisition side. And then we've used the different exit strategies to our advantage on the sales side as well.
Oh, interesting. So lots going on there. So you've been doing this a long time there, right, TJ? So what has kind of been like your biggest failure, but your biggest success so far?
Which one, failure or the success?
We'll do both. Let's start with the failure and then to the success. Because I want to make sure that the listeners understand that, you know, you make it sound very fun, but also very simple because, you know, hey, we're flipping all these properties, you know, we could be making 100K or 20, 30K per flip. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, we could be a bank, be a lender. Now we're making 80 grand and over 13% and stuff like that. So someone who's like, wow, that's great. It must be really easy. But we also want to balance that out to say, well, you know, there's probably been some things that wasn't so easy. I may have made a mistake on or two. So if you can talk about the biggest failure and biggest success, would be great for the listeners.
Yeah, for sure. So it is an easy business, or it's a simple business. It's not an easy business at scale. Anyone can do one deal at a time. Doing 100 units at a time, probably not the smartest thing for your first deal, although that was a lot of fun at the time. I had a lot more energy when I was 25 than I do when I'm 42. So it's, you know, I'm getting old now. But let's talk the biggest failure. Let's just go straight to finances. Probably lost somewhere around $3 million in 2008 to 2010 when the market took a crash. So that sucked. Like that sucks when you're in your late 20s, you think you're on top of the world. And the benefit of being in a boat like that, like I think I said before, is everyone else is in the same boat. So it's really difficult for folks that are getting into the market now to understand, like, man, you must just not have seen anything coming. Well, I mean, kind of, but California, every single property in all of California was 40% off from the highs. Every single residential property, my parents' properties in like San Diego, next to the beach, 35 to 50% off from the highs. Properties that I ended up buying at the bottom of the market after I got out of this multifamily stuff, I was buying properties in California for $45,000 and $50,000, that are now worth, you know, 250 and up. So some of the Inland Empire things in California, for example, took like a 75% haircut from their max value. So that's where I say, like, if stuff hits the fan, everyone's on the same boat. So that leads to the next one, is never be scared of failure and never be scared of expansion. If you have a business model that works, that you're able to control and make work for you. So the biggest success is then relies on in investing in people. So you can't have 11, 10, 11, however many we got in the office. We can't have that many people in the office without investing in their success, which means we're now responsible for their pathway to success. And unlike us, being, you know, company owners and entrepreneurs and, you know, bright-eyed, like, massive goals and all this other stuff, our employees don't want massive goals. They want massive goals for a company, kind of, but they want incremental goals where they can be successful relatively quickly and relatively straightforwardly because they have incremental bills and they have current responsibilities. So if I say I want to buy a private jet in the next 5 to 10 years, that doesn't do anything for anyone on the team except for me and, you know, the other owners to stroke our ego. It's cool. It's awesome. It might be a good goal to have. I don't know. But what's that going to do for the sales guy or the acquisitions guy trying to make 80 to 150 a year? It doesn't do anything for them. What the way we invest in them is through their training and through their ability to be successful in a relatively short amount of time. And there's a lot of risk to that, obviously, for us. They can go somewhere else. They can do it on their own. They can become our competitors. And then that means along with investing in them, we need to keep the team environment and the atmosphere in the company such that people want to come in and work. So that's been the biggest success. We've had an amazing year. It's great. And we're going to have, you know, again, assuming there's no black swan event, we're going to have a great year next year too. But that's because we've invested in the people. It's a big hurdle. If you're used to doing all the different pieces, you think you're good at all the different pieces. It turns out you're actually probably not that good at any of them. You just think that you have to do all of them at once. But once you start employing people that do the pieces for you, it becomes a lot easier and a lot better.
No, it's great. It's great to hear. So, all right, now we're going to have our tips from the pro segment here. So this is when the listeners have sent me questions that they want to ask the expert, like yourself, TJ. So, all right, question number one, I don't have a lot of money to invest in real estate. Where should I start?
You need to find out if you want to be active or passive. If you want to be active, you go out there and just find a deal and the money doesn't matter. You come to someone like us or you wholesale it or you partner with someone with money. If you want to be passive, actually, you probably just invest in like a REIT or some kind of rental property with someone with an operator that you trust. What we're going to start seeing in this marketplace is more and more operators that were good when everyone's good start to get a little bit flakier. So make sure that, you know, make sure the operations guy, whoever's running the actual project, is someone you can trust if you want to be passive.
Okay, perfect. Next question here. Where is the best source to fund any deals that I would find? Would it be a bank, a credit union, or lenders? Or what would you say?
If you get a good deal, the best source is going to be some dude that has a lot of money that trusts you to not screw it up. So you can get 100% financing. If you get a great deal, say you buy a house at 50% of what it's worth and it needs no money whatsoever, you're going to find money real. It needs no repairs whatsoever to make like full ARV or full after repaired value. Finding money for that deal is really, really easy. So try to find that deal. And finding some guy that just is willing to write you a check for 100% of it, you're going to split the profit with him. Maybe hopefully more in your favor than their favor, depending on the risk profile. And then just kind of backtrack from there. So if a deal needs a lot of work, you know, you got to make sure you buy it right, obviously. That's the best place. The second best place is hard money. And then maybe you have, you know, a family member or something that wants to bridge the gap, because hard money is more or less an asset-based loan that you still have to bring some meat on the bone to. You got to bring some equity to the table in order to make sure you don't mess it up. So again, it's going to be a trust issue between you and the, you know, you and the money guy.
Interesting. All right. How do I approach distressed owners? So I know your marketing's out there, or so the people you have that's part of acquisitions to find the leads, what are they, bird dogs or wholesale or whatever, let's say that's one of the easier ones is to find the deal. So for someone who's really new at this, they're saying, okay, well, you know, I'm going to be knocking on a door. Let's say they respond to something. How do I kind of approach them without, looking sleazy, or just, I'm just trying to milk them for all they're worth for like a really, really low price. Like what's that balancing act of compassion? Because to the listeners, then most of these people you're dealing with, because I'm sure a lot of people are saying, well, why don't they just go to a realtor and just sell it regularly? And I guess what people don't understand, for distressed owners, that's usually not the case, because the realtor is going to ask you to do what? Fix it up.
Mm-hmm.
All these
so
different things.
What value? Absolutely. And there's a great place for realtors in the marketplace. A lot of realtors have a fundamental misunderstanding of what value they bring to the table. And therefore, they also have a misunderstanding for what value an investor-based company such as ourselves bring to the table too. And that's what you have to ask yourself. If you're approaching a lead that's in a distressed situation, what value do I offer the lead? And if they're in a distressed situation, I guarantee the value that you bring is not money. Now, money's important, but anyone out there that has money could get that deal. So all if you're doing is leading with money, then you're going to lose the deal to us, and you're going to lose it by $20,000 to $60,000, because we're not leading with money. We're leading with value to the seller. Now you say, well, now we're hurting the seller because we could afford to pay them more. What we're giving the seller is a certainty of an outcome that they don't have already. So for example, if the house is going to go to foreclosure on Tuesday and today is Thursday, and we've done this exact scenario before, we're going to approach that lead in a different way, where we give an absolute certainty that we can avoid foreclosure for them and we can buy their house. And there's going to be a price that makes sense for. And they're going to now not have a foreclosure. Whereas someone else that doesn't know how to do that, doesn't know how to stop a foreclosure, doesn't know how to close in 3 days. What's today? Friday? And we've had Thursday to Tuesday. I don't think we've had Friday to Tuesday. That's tough. but someone else that doesn't know how to do that, you have a high likelihood or a high risk of losing the house now 100%. And you don't want that to happen. And that's an urgency situation. On the other side of the spectrum, we have a lot of sellers that have a certain level of urgency. Maybe someone's in a nursing home, maybe someone unfortunately passed away or whatever. And that's an unfortunate situation, but it's I think life is 100% fatal, unfortunately. I mean, one guy came back once, but he's still kind of around, but we don't see him too often. So we're going to die, which means, well, what now certainty do we offer? Well, we offer someone a certainty of once they've been through a probate process that they know they have a buyer lined up, they can get their money and then get on with their life. Or we can bypass a probate by doing some stuff in Texas with just title paperwork and everyone's still taken care of. But we don't have to go through the headache of the probate process. And that's a great offering. We have properties where, again, I alluded to hoarder houses or that kind of thing, where there's this much trash in there. We tell them it's a big stressor. What is that doing? That's causing stress to someone. And so what do? We relieve that stress by saying, hey, all the stuff that's stressing you out, don't worry about it. It's our business to take care of that. And it's our business to give you a certainty of an outcome. And then it's just a lot of the value that you bring at that point is whether or not the seller likes you. We make a lot of money by being, not me personally, because I'm not very likable. I don't know if you noticed, but we make a lot of money by being likable and approachable and honest with sellers. Honesty is one of our, brutal honesty is one of our kind of company core values, where we will say, hey, we can do this, or we can't do this, and here's why. And that really distinguishes us from a lot of people in the marketplace.
It's pretty cool. It's nice that you went through that response, actually. So you kind of explained, like, you're actually there to help, right? The fact that you're making money off the deal, yeah, great. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're taking something that's painful for them away, right? Because for those who don't want a house, I mean, a lot of people, it's here in Canada, everyone's like, there's always a housing shortage here in Canada, right? Everyone's complaining that we can't find homes or whatever. But then you have people that actually, for some reason, they just really want to get out of the house. Like you said, could be a bunch of different mm-hmm. things. Loved one lost, could be a divorce, could be, you know, they lost their job and they just want to, you know, get something smaller. They don't need something so big. And the stress of trying to sell is can be there. So mm-hmm. it's nice to know that you guys actually help people out that way, in the same way like that. So next question then. So what are your simple tips to, you said you're working on like sometimes 20 or 30 deals at once. How do you keep that deal flow there? Because like you said, I think for most people, you know, maybe if I was to do something, yeah, I want to do one and then see if it works and then do it again, versus you're like, you know what? We'll do a bunch because if there's a couple that are really not going well and we might take a loss on it, at least we have like a bunch of others that are going to bring us up. So how do you keep that deal flow stable?
Yeah. Trick one is make sure you have a solid business. So a lot of people that want to get into flipping, for example, they'll buy four flips and they'll mess up all four of them because they don't have a solid business from the get-go. They don't know their costs. They don't know their expenses. They don't know their contractors. Oh, my contractor screwed me. I haven't been screwed by a contractor in years. Because we know how to control the contractors and we generally use people that we've used for years. So that's huge, is make sure your business is solid, is scalable, and scale is I think it's a dirty word in the industry. Everyone wants to scale their business. Make sure you know the logistics and the issues about scaling, because that becomes another like beast in itself. For us, it's we're not trying to double the size of the team because we want to keep the quality of the team members relatively high and make sure that they can make good money doing what they're doing and what they like doing and that they're good at doing. And for us, what that means is we want to have people that are of higher intelligence, that work in the office, that work in the team, that have the capacity to do different roles if we had to have them do them, but that have enough business doing their singular role to be very successful doing just that role. Because we don't want them to get all over the place and, you know, shiny object in the office even. We want them to be really good at what they're doing. But being smarter and being able to do different roles means that they understand better how their role fits into the bigger picture. And that allows us to scale better. And along with that, just make sure, know where the revenue comes from. Like I said, if you don't have the lead flow to support the team, then it's easy to grow a team. But if you don't have any leads, the team's not making any money, you're not only going to lose the team, you're going to piss off people and you're going to piss off people in the industry. You're going to not get, you know, our biggest draw for getting more employees is the employees that we have. If they're pissed off and leaving, well, we're not going to get more from them, are we? So you got to keep people happy, and you got to make sure that if you're investing in people, you're actually investing in their success and not just using a lot of the flash terms that a lot of the gurus say in the industry to try to, a lot of people, we're really team environment oriented. We want loyalty and all this other stuff. These terms like loyalty, basically as a way to keep people invested in the company and not as a way to actually have the company invest in the people. So they use it as a fear tactic as opposed to an actual loyalty aspect.
All right. Next question I got for you here. Who should be the first person I either employ or I should contract with? So this is from a, hiring perspective, when you have enough deals coming in that it warrants getting some kind of assistance. So what's the first person you're going to hire?
I built our company off of pain points. So same as we buy properties off the pain points. I didn't like talking to sellers, so I hired acquisitions first because I just don't want to talk to sellers. They all got the same story and they're bumming me out because their house smells funny. And I like the sellers. Like, they're nice people. They're generally nice people. So I hired acquisitions first. Probably the most sensible thing to hire first would be admin. So just an assistant, an executive assistant, your wife, your husband that can do some of the back end stuff that is important. So the contracting, the paperwork, because especially if you're flipping, you're doing so many different things. Well, if you're flipping, you probably ought to hire out the contractor side. Like, don't be painting your own houses. I've done that. It's not the smartest thing to do. Like I said in the beginning, I'm not the smartest guy out there. I've just figured out all the ways it didn't work first. But hire admin. If you're flipping, hire the construction. If you don't have enough margin to pay for construction, you probably didn't buy well enough and you're already screwed. So in that case, get rid of that deal first and then get on to the next deal. For me, though, it was acquisitions and then sales.
Yeah. Or even, I guess, maybe a good tip for like just those who are trying to get into this space, really know what that exit strategy is. So not just look for the deal that you want to work on, whether it's going to be a fixing, flipping, rehab, rent it out or whatever. Maybe one of the first things aside from the deal is finding like, what's your plan B of like, okay, well, who is actually like yourself, like your company, TJ, or someone similar to you, or that, okay, for some reason, if I can't get this deal to work, maybe I can work with someone who's already been doing this a long time, and they can just take the deal off my hands and I just make a little bit of money versus me trying to, like you said, paint the walls and hammer in the drywall yourself. So that could be a potential tip for someone make sure you have someone that you can rely on, like another company that can maybe take the deal off your hands if you can't seem to figure that out. So, okay. Last question on tips.
You never want to work out of a point of desperation. That's for sure.
Exactly. Right. And so, yeah, you want to make sure you have all these contingencies in place. Right. So, all right. Next question. Last question here on the tips from the pro segment here. What is the best strategy on dealing with difficult clients or sellers? So I guess I know you probably say you hire acquisitions for that, but have they ever told you some tips, or do they escalate to you if for some reason they're dealing with someone who's being very difficult?
Work through the fundamental problem. Like, work through what's the actual issue. Never take anything personal. Everyone has stressing points. Everyone has issues. Everyone has prejudice. They go into a situation, and it might turn to be aggression on someone on the team. Never take any of that stuff personally. About the situation, they're venting about the situation that oftentimes they put themselves in. And they're not, and they're venting at the acquisition team. They're venting at the people because of the acquisition team. So never take it personal. And our team doesn't. Like, our objective is very much objective or deal, to be honest and ethical about how we get the deal, about how we negotiate the deal with the sellers, with what can happen and what can't happen, what we can do and what we can't do. So our team can get chewed out. Our team can get yelled at. Our team can have, they don't care. I mean, it might affect them a little bit. I don't know. But they know for the seller is not actually because of their position.
Yeah, because you're also targeting distressed sellers, right? Because these are people where something bad is happening. So, you know, you have to kind of expect that when you're kind of, because if you go to a regular person and say, I want to buy your home for X percent less than what the market is, a lot of them would just be like, get out of my house, right? But there are others that will be very emotional about that, right? Because to them, it could be a bunch of different things. So it's good to have to know not to take it personally, because it's easier said than done, right? But I'm glad you have a good training system. And that last question there, where can people reach out to you?
And stuff is on reiaf.com. So that's REI is real estate investing.
Excellent. All right. So thank you again. Thank you again, TJ, for being on.
Please. Hey, you, do you need a voiceover? Well, look no farther. Northway Capital Group has your answer. Commercials and explainer videos, AVR and voicemail, health and wellness, corporate training and e-learning, announcements, documentaries, and biography. Contact us on social media or email us at northwaycapitalgroup@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to the SME Stories podcast, which is owned by Northway Capital Group. Please follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Northway Capital Group.